red lines for this hour. The World Health Organization says there are no more functional hospitals in North Gaza as the death toll from Israel's genocide tops 20,000. A rights advocacy organization says Israel's onslaught on Gaza is the most dangerous situation for journalists, with most journalists killed in a single year in one location. And the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has targeted a major port in the occupied Palestinian territories in response to the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Nothing is more synonymous with barbarism than targeting civilians, women and children in particular. This is what Israel has been doing in the Gaza Strip since the regime launched its war of genocide on the Palestinian territory on October the 7th. More than 20,000 civilians, including more than 8,000 children and over 6,000 women, have been killed in the regime's attacks so far. The latest deadly strikes hit residential areas across the Gaza Strip, including the southern cities of Rafah and Khan Yunis. Nearly 30 people were announced dead following a Thursday bombing of the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. Palestinian officials say many more people are now under the rubble. Hospitals are also amongst Israel's main targets, where the atrocious crimes of the regime are particularly noticeable.
We work in this place daily. There is nothing more difficult. Working here every day, we receive the shock of seeing the martyrs before their own parents. We encounter dismembered bodies, torn limbs and remains. We encounter the sights resulting from the air strikes, the smell of bombardment, the smell of gunpowder, the smell of blood. We endure the initial and most horrific sights before they are endured by the parents of the martyr. When we encounter a tiny child without a head, little children without feet, without hands, small children reduced to dismembered body parts, then we feel very sad. It is a shock. It takes us hours to recover the psychological balance, to recover from the effects of this shock.
Israel's relentless strikes have knocked Gaza's medical facilities out of service. The territory's health ministry says the health system in the north of Gaza has been, quote, liquidated. The World Health Organization has also announced that there are no longer any functional hospitals in the northern part of the Palestinian territory.
Now, Al-Ahli is a shell of a hospital. Until 2 days ago, it was the only hospital where injured people could get surgery in northern Gaza, and that was overwhelmed with patients needing emergency care. But there are no operating theaters anymore due to the lack of fuel, power, medical supplies, and health workers, including surgeons and other specialists. It completely stopped functioning and is only operating as a hospice currently with no or very little care. There are actually no functional hospitals left in the north. Al-Ahli was the last one, but is now minimal functional, and still treating patients but not admitting new ones, along with Al-Shifa, Al-Ada and Al-Sahaba Hospital. WHO will keep striving to supply health facilities in the northern Gaza, but without fuel, staff, and other essential needs, medicines, medicines won't make a difference, and all patients will die slowly and painfully.
Various UN agencies have painted a harrowing picture of hunger in the besieged Gaza Strip as Israel continues its brutal aggression against the Palestinian territory. The UN's hunger monitoring system says Gazan households are facing the highest level of food insecurity and hunger that it has ever recorded globally. The Integrated Food Security Phase classification added in its report that the most likely scenario in Gaza is that by February the 7th, its entire population would be at a crisis or worse levels of hunger. The report said there is a risk of famine in Gaza if the current situation continues. The World Food Programme also weighed in on the report, saying it's indicative of the devastating situation in Gaza.
So, essentially, this report sort of confirms our worst fears in terms of the really, truly devastating situation which Gaza is experiencing right now. Pretty much all 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation. About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving.
The World Health Organization also raised the alarm about the dire humanitarian situation in the Gaza Strip. The WHO said hunger is ravaging Gaza and this is expected to increase illness across the territory. It added that disease and hunger will lead to more deaths in Gaza. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has released new footage showing three Israeli captives held in Gaza and killed in the regime's airstrikes. The Al-Ghassan Brigade spokesman said the captives were killed despite efforts to preserve their lives. Abu Ubaidah said Israel must stop its onslaught to get its captives alive. He said Israel needs to accept the conditions put forward by the resistance. Abu Ubaidah added that Israel's objective to eliminate Hamas in Gaza was doomed to fail. The regime's military has killed Hamas-held captives on several occasions. It has confirmed the killing of at least three captives in Gaza during the ground offensive since early October. The Israeli military has said troops mistook the captives as threats and shot them dead. Israel's onslaught on Gaza has taken a heavy toll on journalists that cover the regime's bloody aggression against the besieged territory. Now, a US-based rights advocacy organization says the Israeli aggression on Gaza is the most dangerous situation for journalists. The Committee to Protect Journalists says the first 10 weeks of the regime's genocide were the deadliest recorded ever for journalists, with the most journalists killed in a single year in one location. It also expressed concerns over what it described as an apparent pattern of targeting journalists by the Israeli regime. The CPJ says this issue, along with intense bombardment of Gaza, has prevented foreign journalists from independently accessing the situation in Gaza. Nearly 70 reporters and media workers have been killed since Israel's onslaught on Gaza started on October the 7th, 61 of them Palestinian. The regime has been also deliberately killing journalists' families who serve as a source for investigators looking into how those journalists died. Social media giants have been systematically silencing pro-Palestine voices during Israel's ongoing onslaught on Gaza. Their biased approach has been criticized by human rights groups that say the censorship is furthering the erasure of Palestinian suffering. We were joined earlier by author and activist Lucas Gage, who has faced such restrictions.
So I've been posting several things that have been pushing the limits of free speech. I've been pissing off the Israelis. I've been talking about things that, could offend some people, you know, allowing this free speech to occur. And the Zionists had enough of me. So they started to mass report my accounts, calling me anti-Semite, Nazi, white supremacist, Jew hater, yada, 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 the same old spiel. They actually have a picture of a bunch of us, the people that I work with. They X'd me out because I eventually got banned today. And there are things that I said that, you know, could offend some people, but I got banned for a rant that I made about Jewish supremacists, Zionism, this kind of thing. And they took my rant out of context, saying that I want to kill Jewish people, when in the next sentence I explain all you need to do is shame these Zionists and Jewish supremacists, call them out and show them what they're doing, laughing at children, making fun of people here, wanting more death and destruction. I mean, if you look at X, all these Zionist accounts are calling to level Gaza. There are no innocents in Gaza. James Woods, an actor, said, kill them all. They're not making any differentiation between civilians or not. So there are people like us and my side saying, you know, we got to free Gaza. We got to help the Palestinians. And so I pushed the limits back to these people, and they decided to terminate me. And so it just goes to show that even X is being affected by this. We thought it was Facebook, Meta, Instagram, but even X is being pressured by Zionist lobbies and power. And we know that Elon Musk went to Israel, and he's got a dog tag on him. He's like, bring the hostages back, the whole nine yards of propaganda that he's fallen for, hook, line, and sinker. And we're seeing that reflection now. So I was a very big account, a very big thorn into the Zionist entity, and they didn't like me much, so they all flagged everything possible.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq says it has attacked the port of Umm al-Rashrash in the occupied territories in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Iraqi resistance says it struck its target in the port city, which is known in Israel as Eilat, with appropriate weapons. It added that the operation was carried out in response to Israel's massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children, in Gaza. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has already carried out a number of attacks on the occupied port city. It has also targeted major American military bases in Syria and Iraq during the past months in response to the U.S. support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. New clashes have taken place between Hezbollah and Israel along Lebanon's southern border. Hezbollah has launched a drone strike on an Israeli military position in the occupied Shebar Farms. The regime's military positions in the Margaliot area have also been targeted with rockets. Our Beirut correspondent joined us earlier with more details.
So we have definitely seen that the Israelis are taking steps that are not acceptable by the resistance. And so therefore we see that Hezbollah is stepping up their operations. Today, of course, we had several operations. There were at least seven operations. Two of them were conducted in the middle of the night in response to the targeting and the killing of a civilian. Today also we had the martyrdom of a civilian woman in the town of Marun al-Ras. We have her husband is severely injured. The resistance specifically retaliated for this, naming the woman in person. They directly said that this is in retaliation when they targeted the Kiryat Shmona camp. But you also have something new, which is the fact that Hezbollah said that they will be reciprocal when it comes to how they target things. So if the Israelis target a civilian house, they will try to also destroy the settlements. We've seen that in Motilin also today, and the fact that they also targeted a Merkava tank. We also saw that Hezbollah used drones today, again, to target gatherings of soldiers in towns that are Aviv and Doviv, which are considered the occupied Lebanese town of Salha.
Iran's permanent ambassador to the United Nations has warned against any provocative actions by Israel, saying such moves could seriously impact peace and security in West Asia. Amir Saeed Iravani was addressing a UN Security Council meeting on the situation in Syria. He condemned Israel's frequent attacks against the Arab country. Iravani said the regime is engaged in terrorism and aggression within Syrian borders and internationally targets civilians and critical infrastructure. Iran's UN envoy urged the Security Council to condemn Israel's strikes on Syria.
Iran called on the Security Council to condemn the destabilizing activities of the Israeli regime and its severe violation of Syrian sovereignty and territorial integrity, which pose a threat to peace and stability in the region.
Iravani said it's Syria's inherent right under international law to take all necessary measures in response to Israel's terrorist attacks and acts of aggression. Iran's envoy also lashed out at the US and the UK for accusing the Islamic Republic of destabilizing West Asia. Iravani stressed that Iran has consistently demonstrated its commitment to promoting peace and security in the region. He also condemned the United States' unlawful military presence in Syria.
The security situation in areas controlled by illegal foreign forces and under occupation is a matter of serious concern. The primary source of insecurity is unlawful presence and continued occupation of U.S. military forces, creating an environment conducive to the growth of the terrorist activities within Syria and the broader region. The United States is fully responsible for its decade-long aggressions along with other crimes and unlawful measures in our region.
The Iranian diplomat also touched upon Israel's brutal war in the Gaza Strip and denounced the regime's atrocities there. Iravani harshly criticized the U.S. for vetoing all U.N. Security Council resolutions that called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
Obstructing the Security Council from fulfilling its charter-based duties to establish a ceasefire and to stop the Israeli war machine against the people of Gaza for more than 2 months has called in doubt the U.S. real concerns about the spillover of the tension and peace and security in the region.
The last night of the fall is referred to as Yalda night in Iran. Every year on this night, Iranians celebrate with family and friends. However, this year the occasion is overshadowed by the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Gisumish Ahmadi tells us more.
Iconic green and red decorations and ornaments, colors that represent nature, growth, love, and joy. Yalda-themed clothing and accessories, and shops offering last-minute buyers special offers. Pomegranates and watermelons featured in almost every item you come across, be it on the streets or browsing through online shops. Yalda is here, the last night of autumn and the longest night of the year. According to Persian tradition, a time to celebrate the victory of light over darkness.
Traditionally, Iranians get together on this night, usually at their grandparents' or other elders of the family. They spend the night eating pomegranates and watermelons, and also nuts referred to as Yalda nuts. They also read and interpret Hafez poems for fun and wish each other well.
Celebrating Yalda night is one of the most beautiful traditions of us Iranians. If I'm not mistaken, Yalda night was officially registered by UNESCO as a cultural heritage last year. However, overshadowed by the ongoing war in Gaza, the Yalda night celebration this year is not as colorful for Iranians as it ought to be. And this is even reflected in urban paintings. Just like many Christians across the world who are gearing up for a subdued Christmas marked with signs of solidarity with Palestinians.
We wish for the liberation of the Palestinian nation, an end to the occupation, and a happy new year.
The shops are not as crowded as they usually are this time of the year, as many Iranian families have chosen to cut back on their Yalda night spending to donate to Gaza instead.
Iranians have always supported the people of Palestine, and now with the ongoing war in Gaza, this has even affected happy occasions such as Yalda night. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
That's it for this hour's bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. In the Limelight. Due to sparse traffic at Israel's Ben-Gurion International Airport, the airport authority has decided to put 600 employees on unpaid leave, according to Israeli media. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The airport authority at Ben Gurion Airport decided on the move after negotiations with the Workers' Committee after almost all foreign airlines stopped flying to Ben Gurion Airport due to the war, the Hebrew version of the Ynet News website reported recently. 600 employees will be placed on unpaid leave and 1,000 more will be reduced to 75% of their current jobs, the newspaper reported, citing official sources. For its part, the Israeli Broadcasting Corporation, the KAN, reported that the number of workers at Ben-Gurion Airport is 4,600 employees. Following the job cuts, the number will be reduced to 3,000. The global demand for travel to the occupied Palestinian territories has increased significantly since the launch of the Al-Aqsa flood operation and Israel's war on Gaza. The majority of international companies have suspended flights to and from the Israeli airport. We hope that the scope of activity in Israel will continue to expand and that we'll be able to get workers back to work as soon as possible, the Israeli Airport Authority said in a statement. The statement added, the Airport Authority hoped that the war would not affect the functioning of the airports, but hopes are separate from reality. Industry sources said that the decision to put the workers on unpaid leave was made only in recent days after seeing that the expectation was that the Ben-Gurion Airport would not return to normal operations in January as well, according to the Ynet News website. Pinchas Idan, chairman of the Workers' Committee, told Ynet News, I pray that the war will end as soon as possible and that the work will return in full. We did the right thing because after COVID-19 pandemic, we drew conclusions. According to the Cradle, on 6th of November this year, the Financial Times published an extraordinary investigation tracking the devastating economic toll of Israel's war on Gaza, its impact reverberating across personal finances, job markets, businesses, industries, and the Israeli government itself. The Financial Times reports that the war had disrupted and ravaged thousands of companies, many teetering on the brink of collapse, with entire sectors plunged into an unprecedented crisis. Data cited from Israel's Central Bureau of Statistics reveal a bleak reality. One in three businesses in Israel have either shuttered or are operating at 20% capacity since Operation Al-Aqsa flood commenced on 7th of October and punched a hole in Israeli national confidence. More than half of businesses face revenue losses surpassing the 50% mark. The southern regions close to Gaza bear the brunt, with two-thirds of businesses either closed or functioning to a minimum. Adding to the crisis, Israel's labor ministry reports that 764,000 citizens, close to a fifth of Israel's workforce, are jobless due to evacuations, school closures, mandating childcare responsibilities, or reverse duty call-ups. Recently, the Bloomberg News Agency put numbers to the economic impact of Tel Aviv's military belligerence. The Gaza war has cost the Israeli economy almost $8 billion to date, with a further $260 million in losses occurred with every day that passes. Despite this, the dire situation, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who is heavily reliant on support from right-wing, ultra-Zionist political factions, persists in allocating vast sums to non-essential ideological and settler colonial projects, diverging from the typical wartime economy protocol. Netanyahu has earmarked a record 14 billion shekels, or $3.6 billion, in discretionary spending for the five political parties comprising his coalition government, much of it intended for religious schools and the development of illegal Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank. In a bitter irony of the war in Gaza, multiple Israeli construction projects have temporarily ground to a halt as they primarily relied on exploitation of Palestinian labourers. The Financial Times reports that Israelis are upset at the sight of Arab workers holding heavy tools, so they don't want to have Palestinian workers there. Such disenfranchisement comes despite many businesses being reduced to pleading for donations to remain afloat. Tourism, a potential economic lifeline, offers little respite for Tel Aviv. Figures from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, depict international travel contributing a mere 2.8% to Israel's gross domestic product and supporting 230,000 jobs, just over 6% of the total workforce. Despite persistent efforts throughout 2022 to revive tourism, October saw a massive 76% year-on-year decline in tourism. The onset of Al-Aqsa flood operation further decimated travel, with daily flights to and from Ben Gurion Airport plummeting from 500 to a mere 100. The catastrophe unfolding is not lost on Tel Aviv's economists, 300 of which, on 1st of November, urged Prime Minister Netanyahu and his finance ministers to come to your senses due to the grave blow that Israel was dealt. They believe the cataclysm requires a fundamental change in national priorities and a massive rechanneling of funds to deal with war damage, aid to victims, and the rehabilitation of Israel's economy. Despite such rhetorical bombast, there are ample indications the Zionist regime is as dangerously deluded about its economic sustainability as its military prowess. Reports published by Tel Aviv's Startup Nation Policy Institute think tank reveal a grim outlook. Just 2 weeks after the Al-Aqsa flood operation erupted, the organization issued a study on damage to Israel's technology sector, once a source of national pride and joy, and a bellwether for its prosperity more generally. Even at that early stage, the Startup Nation Policy Institute forecast a rapidly impending economic crisis whose force is still unknown based on its survey. In all, 80% of Israeli technology firms reported damage resulting from the country's worsening security situation, while a quarter recorded double damage, both in human resources and in obtaining investment capital. Over 40% of technology companies had investment agreements delayed or cancelled, or just 10% were in managing to have meetings with their investors. The uncertainty and the resulting decision of many investors to sit on the fence due to the current situation hits an ecosystem that was already struggling to raise capital, partially due to the potential instability on the eve of the war, combined with a worldwide economic recession. Another reason for the Israeli technology sector's failure, unmentioned by the SNP but investigated by the Cradle on 13th of October, is the exposure of Tel Aviv's electronic surveillance and warfare system vulnerabilities by Al-Aqsa flood operation. That report concluded that Palestinian resistance operation would likely lead to a significant decline in the fortunes of Israel's cybersecurity sector, given it represents a grave and potentially terminal blow to the Startup Nation brand, which relies heavily on cybersecurity. The subsequent events have borne out this prediction.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Umebiha Mukhtar. And our guest today is Sister Salma Khalfan, an Islamic researcher who is going to enlighten us about hijab according to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei. Salamun alaikum and welcome, Sister Salma.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for coming. What has Ayatollah Khamenei got to mention about the relationship between men and women regarding the aspect of hijab?
Okay, bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Ayatollah Khamenei says that men and women are required to observe a limit in the relationship. Very good point here. He says also, look at his broad-mindedness in this aspect. He says that they can talk to one another. They can do even business with one another. Yeah. And they can also argue one another. They can be a teacher of one another. Okay? Either man to a woman or woman to a man.
Yeah.
But within a limit. But there are limits that they must observe. And this is an Islamic rule to observe limitations, that is. And it should be observed. Overstepping the limits, destroying woman's human dignity. That means if one oversteps the limits, yeah, he destroys the woman's dignity in turn. And then this woman who engaged too much, you know, by interacting with men, either as a friend, as a business partner, as a student or a teacher, if she oversteps her limit and isn't concerned about the, you know, the way she talks or the way she, the mode of her voice, her tone, and, you know, how she makes jokes or, you know, that is all exceeding limit, then she becomes an object of pleasure.
Oh.
Yeah. And using them and becomes like a means of marketing. Marketing them and their flashy ornaments are prohibited in Islam.
I think I remember an example to this where... there was a boxer, you know, before boxing matches, they have these women who come and like kind of walk around in very skimpy clothing. And he said that, look, I don't want these women to come before my match. He was a Muslim boxer. And he said, because I feel this is just, you know, I don't want women to show off their bodies. I don't feel this is, you know, respectful to a woman. After this, a woman comes and says, this is their job. They're supposed to come and look beautiful before the scene. After that, so many people were saying this is exactly what kind of disregard, like degrades a woman, you know, that what is she, an object where people are supposed to just look at her beauty? This is exactly what is happening right now, where women are looked at as just objects. They think they're being empowered because, you know, they're now given equal rights, supposedly. But then at the same time, they are also being really looked down upon as just objects of pleasure.
Yeah. And the beauty will, you know, fade away.
Yeah.
And then they won't be respected then because they won't have that beauty. Whilst Allah wants that inner beauty to shine, right?
Yes, exactly.
The woman's real worth to come out. So Ayatollah keeps on saying that Islam says that women should increase their honor and dignity. That is the inner beauty. They should see in what mode they should they interact with the men.
Yeah.
Women are advised to achieve enough honor and dignity. That means they should have that izzat enoughs in them. Okay?
What's izzat enoughs?
Izzat enoughs is something that you respect yourself.
Hmm.
When you respect yourself, you don't want to mingle, overreact. You want to see how you talk, what you talk, in what manner you talk,
yeah,
and how long you talk. What kind of a relationship with men do you have? Do you have an over-friendly relationship? All this pertains to a woman's real, real character of her, how she respects herself.
True.
If she overdoes it.
Yeah.
But if she does it to the right proportion and when it's necessary, then it is allowed. Like the way Ayatollah Khamenei says, she should be very, you know, like careful whether she's being watched by a man or not. This is the relationship. Okay? And there's a lot of difference between these ideal Muslim women and women who painstakingly select the clothes, the makeup, and the gait in order to attract a person. There's so many differences, he says, from a woman who is dignified and virtuous and thinks of her dignity and has izzat enough, yeah, than the woman who chooses just hours on to, you know, portray herself when she's going to a place, that what she'll wear, what makeup she'll put on. All this is a wastage of time for her if she's doing it for a namahram, right?
It's true. And I think this is the whole, you know, behind the scenes kind of plans happening. If hijab becomes so prominent where now, you know, women are not so out there trying to work on different kinds of makeup products, you know, to make themselves look as flashy or beautiful outside, this million-dollar industry of makeup will go really low. The business of makeup is so high that so many businesses will flop if women stop using makeup. Like, this is a whole scheme that's going on. And
yeah, it's a strategy.
It's really very interesting. So we're just going to take a small brief intermission and we'll be continuing shortly.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady. And today we have been discussing about what Ayatollah Khamenei has got to mention about the relationship between men and women. And Sister Salma, you have told us that it's important for a man and a woman to, you know, stay and observe the limits between themselves, and that it's okay for them to have some sort of relation.
The limits of chastity.
Yes, between the limits of chastity.
Further on says that Ayatollah Khamenei, that the existence of a distance between men and women is itself a primary principle. And it is not a matter of wearing a chadar only, a veil only. That distance should be maintained. You know, naturally, as we pointed out in our previous session, that women are inclined to be chaste.
Yeah?
So that chastity begins from the inside. And you will see that even women who don't wear hijab and they are good people, they are good women, they will always refrain from having over friendly relation with a man.
Yeah.
And they will always be shy in front of the opposite sex because they will want to maintain that izzat enough, that dignity of theirs, that respect within themselves. That if they talk, they don't want to be looked upon with, you know, those kind of eyes that will give her a bad image in herself, and she's judged by her beauty. No, and she wants to be respected.
Yeah, and I think when women say, you know, oh, we don't want to be catcalled outside, we don't want people to look at us the way they're looking.
It's become so opposite, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of like if you don't want something to happen to you, then you have to try and do the things necessary. If I don't want to be catcalled outside, I would try and, you know, cover myself. It's for myself. It's not for them. It's for myself. Like, I don't want this to happen to me. So I feel like that kind of distinction is kind of not looked at nowadays. That, they should cover themselves. They should look down. They should not watch me. If I should be
Or free. I should fit in the society. And everybody is not observing, so I should also observe.
Yeah.
In Western countries, for example,
even
some Muslim women do that. You know, they feel that I'll be the odd one out.
True.
They don't know that this is just giving herself that image that will destroy her, her generations, her virtues, her taqwa, or, you know, her piety. This is so important. So Ayatollah Khamenei beautifully says that with this hijab, you can achieve that loftier achievements of taqwa, virtues, good generation, you know, respect, all these things. It is related to our values. Observing hijab helps women achieve a high spiritual position and avoid common pitfalls. And that is why Ayatollah says that I stress on hijab so much. What a beautiful way of expressing that, you know, a man is so concerned about his society that he's saying that I'm so concerned, that that's why I stress on hijab so much.
Yeah, he's so caring for us. I feel like we kind of confuse that with, oh, he's so overbearing, you know, like why that's is he right. forcing this on us, you know, this is against the freedom that, you know, the West or the people out
or
there
it's an Iranian say. Law rather or, yeah, it's an Islamic Iranian. Law right
it's an Islamic
in
law.
The Quran,
like Allah our creator has, you know, said this is how we should be, this is what we should do for our benefit, for our safety, but we tend to forget that. So let's just take a quick break and we'll be back soon, inshallah. Welcome back. This is Muslim Lady, and we have been discussing with Sister Salma about Ayatollah Khamenei's views on the relationship between men and women regarding the aspect of hijab. And she has mentioned very important points, one of which is because a woman wants to strive to, you know, attain that higher spiritual position, which hijab kind of gives that path for her to reach. I think we would like to ask you another question, if you don't mind. Does he mention more about why a woman should observe this code of dress as per the Islamic Sharia?
Yes, he does. In fact, he says showing off one's physical attraction is prohibited in Islam.
Okay.
You know, normally a woman has this tendency of wanting to show her beauty.
Yeah.
When she does that, because Allah has created her in such a beautiful form, in comparison to men, of course, she's more beautiful. So because of that, Allah says that I don't want men to take advantage of you.
Yeah.
So now it's prohibited for you in Islam. It's a law in Islam, not only in, you know, like a national level of Iran. No,
yeah.
It's a law in Islam to hide your beauty in a way that you neutralize that so that your real worth shows through your character, personality, your attributes. You know, and this is very important to everyone. If you go and see, even if a doctor, she doesn't need to beautify herself. When the people know that she's a doctor, they will look at her up to her with through her, you know, this her being a doctor, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So not her being a woman as such. They will just call her even a doctor. But a woman who, you know, appears fashionably and displays her beauty, then even that doctorate won't show first.
True.
You know, only her beauty will show. And she would not like that also. Would a woman like that she be judged by her outer beauty rather than her qualifications?
No. In fact, this is supposedly their claims today that, oh, we want to be seen as who we are. We want, oh, you know, to do this work and this work so that, you know, we're not the lower gender,
yeah.
You know.
They're so naive. They fail to understand that that is not through the outer beauty. It's through the inner beauty, right?
Yeah.
So His Eminence says that in Islam, women have been prohibited from showing off their beauty in order to attract men or cause fitna. Again, the word fitna comes here. That is, in order to cause temptation. Here it means temptation.
Yeah.
Showing off one's physical attraction to men is a kind of temptation to men. And it can cause various problems. And so many problems, I believe. It is not a matter of a young girl or boy committing a sin. In fact, he says this is the first, and maybe it's a small problem because it's starting with that, you know.
True.
But it ends with what? Because we know shaitan gets through what? Step by step. Khutwati shaitan, in the Quran it says that he gets you step by step. The consequences, he says, the consequences will affect the family and the society. That's very important. Basically, such unprincipled relationship between men and women is a deadly poison that can affect the health of the family, the well-being of the family. That is because of the survival of family depends on love,
yeah,
not on beauty.
Like what you said, it's like a dominoes effect, you know? Because when a woman is unchaste, it kind of brings this temptation, as you said. You know, the men, their focus goes into these kind of things after their carnal desires. You know, marriage is now done very late.
Regarded as secondary.
Yeah. And then marriages are late, you know, and then marriages are weak, and then there's more, you know.
Breakup of marriages.
Yeah, breakups. And all of this is kind of breaking the society.
Yes.
And if you look at the West right now, which is right, why we are bringing the West so much right now is because it's kind of looked at as the ideal society.
Yes.
How much has it collapsed at this moment?
Yes.
And the woman is such a vital role. I feel like we kind of forget the woman's role over here.
Other than the framework of the family, the stability of the family will be undermined, leading to the situation that Western countries are currently suffering from, as you stated.
Very true, very true. This was very enlightening, and thank you very much for your valuable time. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. This was Hijab with Sister Salma Khalfan, and we will see you in the next episode, inshallah. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In a judgment that delivers a potential hammer blow to the British government policy, Court of Appeal judges ruled that it is unlawful to send asylum seekers to Rwanda to have their claims processed. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. Britain's Home Secretary James Cleverly has signed a new Rwanda treaty in which a fresh effort by the Tories aimed at reviving one of its failed plans to deal with the migrant inflow. The plan to send asylum seekers to Rwanda is a key pillar of Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's policy to stop the boats of migrants arriving from France and convince the British public that No. 10 Downing Street is doing all it can to stop asylum seekers. The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has been facing criticism over figures showing net legal immigration reached a record high last year in Britain. The treaty signed with Rwanda on Tuesday, 5th of December, aims to resolve Rishi Sunak's immigration problems. The revived plan aims to send asylum seekers landing in the United Kingdom to the African nation of Rwanda, and head off criticism over the government's failed asylum efforts. James Cleverly said he expected migrants to be heading to Rwanda in the coming months. He claimed the new treaty had addressed all the problems that had been raised by Britain's Supreme Court. Cleverly said to reporters in Kigali, Rwanda, "I really hope that we can now move quickly." The new migrant treaty, which replaced the former Memorandum of Understanding signed between Britain and Rwanda, came ahead of emergency legislation to be pushed through in the coming days. A new policy set to be introduced in Westminster. Under Prime Minister Sunak's government plan, London intends to send thousands of asylum seekers who arrived on its shores without permission to Rwanda to deter migrants from crossing the channel from Europe on small boats, causing a migrant crisis in the country. Stop the boats is one of five goals that Prime Minister Sunak set for his government to end the flow of asylum seekers. Turkey's Anadolu news agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Recently, Britain's Supreme Court ruled unanimously that asylum seekers sent to Rwanda were at real risk of being sent back to their home countries without proper assessment of their claims. However, British government officials claim the new treaty reportedly provides that anyone sent to Rwanda is given permanent leave to remain there even if their asylum applications fail, allowing them to work and access public services. The British government's first group of migrants relocated to Rwanda was scheduled to go last summer, but the flight taking them there was cancelled at the last moment because of legal shortcomings and various points raised by the courts of law. The courts of law pointed out Britain's obligations to refugees under domestic and international laws. Legal experts said Rwanda's human rights record meant the government highly contentious policy could be challenged in the courts of law and also in Parliament. According to one expert at a British legal firm, you cannot in a matter of weeks or months return a country and turn it into one with impartial judiciary and administrative culture. The treaty appears to be yet more fairy tale politics and completely unworkable. The Labour Party's Home Affairs spokeswoman Yvette Cooper dismissed the Sunak government's effort to revive the Rwanda plan as simply a gimmick, and noted the government had so far sent more Home Secretaries to Rwanda than asylum seekers. Yvette Cooper said Labour plans to ditch the Rwanda plan if it wins the next general election. The latest public survey in Britain suggests migration has become one of the top three concerns of the British electorate ahead of the general election expected next year, after the economy and healthcare. The Labour Party has a double-digit lead in the opinion polls. Meanwhile, Rwanda has received an initial payment of £140 million, with the promise of more money to fund accommodation and care of the planned asylum seekers deported to the country. Rwanda's Foreign Minister, Vincent Biruta, claimed on Tuesday, 5th of December, that his government was doing the right thing, despite being unfairly treated by international organisations and the media. He said those who are criticising us should bring up an alternative to the solution we're proposing. The Rwandan Foreign Minister, Vincent Biruta, added, "There is a need to tackle the underlying challenges driving people from their homelands." British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. In a judgment that delivers a potential hammer blow to the British government policy, the Court of Appeal judges ruled that it is unlawful to send asylum seekers to Rwanda to have their claims processed. Britain's Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said in a statement that the government would now seek permission to appeal against the decision at the Supreme Court. and soon claimed Rwanda was a safe country and stated that the court had agreed with this. The ruling follows a recent four-day hearing against the High Court decision last December that it was lawful to send some asylum seekers, including people arriving on small boats, to Rwanda to have their claims processed rather than dealing with their applications for sanctuary in Britain. The illegal migration bill, now passing through Parliament, states that all asylum seekers arriving via irregular means could face being forcibly removed to Rwanda. Prime Minister Sunak continued, "While I respect the court, I fundamentally disagree with their conclusions. I strongly believe the Rwandan government has provided the assurances necessary to ensure there is no real risk that asylum seekers relocated under the Rwanda policy would be wrongly returned to third countries, something that the Lord Chief Justice agrees with." Sunak added, "The policy of this government is very simple. It is this country and your government who should decide who comes here, not criminal gangs. And I will do whatever is necessary to make that happen." However, the opposition Labour Party claimed that the government's policy on so-called small boats crossing the Channel was now completely unravelling. The Shadow Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, said the Rwanda scheme was unworkable, unethical and extortionate. Lord Burnett, who heard the appeal with Sir Geoffrey Voss and Lord Justice Underhill, stated the court had ruled by a majority that the policy of removing asylum seekers to Rwanda was unlawful, though he disagreed with the other two judges. Those who supported the appeal against the ruling included the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, lawyers, charities, and a group of asylum seekers. The court heard from UNHCR that Rwanda had a record of human rights abuses towards refugees within its borders, including refoulement, forced removal to countries where they are at risk, expulsions and arbitrary detention. The refugee agency announced that the Home Office would not be able to guarantee the safety of asylum seekers who were deported to Rwanda. But Sir James EDKC, counsel for the Home Secretary, claimed he was confident that the government of Rwanda would abide by undertakings given in a memorandum of understanding signed by the two countries.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.